Just like a little bit about me. I grew up in Torrance, which is around LA, and I grew up in the church. I have the classic testimony of I grew up in a Christian household and learned about Jesus my whole life. And during high school, I kind of didn't want to follow Jesus because it just seemed kind of pointless to me. And basically, long story short is I had a bunch of friends that went to Korean churches in Torrance, and they all brought me to Korean churches, even though I'm not Korean, and ended up kind of meeting Jesus again and really figuring out how to follow him, not just like in my words, but in my actions, which is going to be a lot of what I talk about today, of just like how do we follow Jesus with our actions. But if you guys want to grab your Bibles and open up to Matthew 5, I think, are there Bibles underneath the chairs?
Yes, there are.
Everybody's got a Bible, because underneath your chair. If you would open up to Matthew 5, verse 21. I feel like every time I get up to speak, and I'm part of Isla Vista Church in Isla Vista, and I've preached a fair number of times, and I feel like every time I preach, I kind of get this, like I get up and I'm like, all right, here's the passage we're going to read, and then I read the verse, and I'm like, man, do I even need to talk? Like, this is already so convicting, you know? And I feel like a lot of times for us, it's either we don't have the discipline to read our Bibles ourselves, or we just kind of find it pointless, but like, when you actually sit down and read this book, it's convicting, and it's real, and it literally like searches who you are and pulls out the depths of who you are. And a lot of times it's like the ugly stuff, but it's the stuff that we need. And so as I read this, like, I don't want everything I say, you should be able to find in here and get on your own by yourself, right? Like, I shouldn't have to, I mean, I'm going to help and I'm going to like teach through and expound on stuff and I have a bunch of pages here of notes that hopefully are going to help us. But like at the end of the day, like this should be where we're getting our life from. And this should be like where we're getting the truth from. So let's read this together. Matthew 5 verse 21. I'm going to read to 26. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent. I'm going to read verse 21 and 22 again. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Okay, first of all, that's pretty much what I'm talking about when I say this is convicting enough. Like, when I read this, when you read a sentence like, whoever says you fool shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell, like it's kind of scary, right? Because I feel like a lot of us, I think we're so used to separating what we say and what we believe, in the sense that like we're all here and we're all gathered because we believe in Jesus, and we're here because we want to worship him and we want to learn about him. But then it's so easy for us to be very careless with our words, right? And we don't assume that there's going to be any sort of repercussion for saying something as like casual as like, oh, you fool. Does this make any sense? And I feel like a lot of times we read through this and we see the gospel and we see Jesus come and we're like, oh, okay, God came to bring grace, right? Like Jesus came and he came to bring grace and he came to bring an ability for us to like not get the repercussion of our sins, but he took that for us, and that's true. But when you look here in verse 21, he says, you have heard that the ancients were told you shall not commit murder, which comes from, I mean, that comes from when Israel got the law, right? Israel gets a law, and God says, don't commit murder, right? And Jesus comes and says, you heard it said, you shall not commit murder, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. So yes, Jesus brought grace, but even in this verse, you see that Jesus upped the standard. He goes, yeah, okay, don't kill anybody, but the root of killing somebody is anger, right? And the roots of anger are revealed by what you say. So he's saying, like, yes, okay, maybe you didn't kill somebody, but the minute you look at your brother and say, you fool, you're already planting the seeds in your heart that lead to murder. And I know that sounds like an exaggeration, but I'm saying that to make a point of, like, Jesus saying you can't separate the heart condition from the result. Like, just because you didn't murder somebody doesn't excuse you from the anger in your heart. And I think in this, there's kind of this, like, blessing and raising of the standard that comes, where, you know, Jesus comes and he brings the grace of, like, hey, your sins are forgiven, but the grace that he brings isn't an excuse for us to get lazy, right? Like, the grace isn't like, okay, well, my sins are forgiven, so I can kind of carry whatever I want in my heart, and I can carry whatever attitudes I want in my heart, and it's going to be fine because Jesus took care of it. Like, the idea is, like, Jesus brought grace, and that grace raised the standard even higher, right? Before, God's like, hey, I'm going to hold you to a standard of, like, you're not supposed to murder. And, like, here's this standard, and you can hold this standard. And then Jesus comes and dies on the cross and takes care of our sin, and he says, okay, well, because I took care of your sin, and because I've given you an ability to have my spirit inside of you, like, I'm going to raise this bar even higher. Like, it's not that you just shouldn't murder somebody, it's that you shouldn't even carry the anger in your heart that could lead to anything like murder. And I think for us, this should, I mean, even for me, like, when I was preparing this and reading this, it's so humbling for me that Jesus here equates anger with murder, which is weird. Because, like, we carry this, I know we all do this because I do this, maybe I'm the only one that does this. All right, I'm going to say this, maybe I'm the only one that does this. But, like, it's so easy to compare yourself and be like, well, at least I don't do that, right? Like, you could be like, yeah, you know, like, I'm addicted to, you know, alcohol, but, like, at least I'm not selling drugs, right? Or it's like, yeah, like, I'm impatient, but, like, at least I'm not out there murdering people, you know? And we get kind of this, like, we justify ourselves by comparison of, like, yes, there's this unrighteous part of me, but at least I'm not that unrighteous, right? And Jesus here addressing that is, like, it's so easy for us to go, like, yes, I'm angry with my brother or I'm angry with my sister, but, like, at least I'm not killing them, you know? And I think part of that is Jesus is going, like, no, you're held accountable to the root in your heart. Like, this isn't an excuse for you to compare yourself to the person next to you and say, at least I'm not doing this terrible thing. Like, he's saying, I see your heart, and that thing has to be pure. Which, I mean, you guys, we already read this when in the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, right? When he goes through the Beatitudes and Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Is Jesus has this kind of outline going through of, like, you know, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, to put this in context, like, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus going, this is who you are. Like, if you're going to follow me and be a follower in the kingdom, you're going to be gentle. You're going to be poor in spirit. You're going to be pure in heart. You're going to be a peacemaker. You're going to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Like, Jesus is saying, when you follow me, this is who you are, right? And then, like you heard, I think it was last week, the salt and the light, right? Then he goes into, like, you are salt. And you are light. Like, if you're in the kingdom and if you're following me, this is who you are. And this is who you're supposed to be, right? And then, in verse 21 and 22, right, when he starts talking about anger, Jesus is going to go into this section where he's telling you this is how you are supposed to do those things, right? It's not just that, okay, here you are, your salt, your light, go. Like, it doesn't matter how you do that. Like, just salt things, light things, right? Like, he's saying there's a standard to that. Which for us comes into the context of, like, what do we understand as being a Christian? Because I, even growing up, for me, like, it was so easy to understand being a Christian as what I did, and it didn't matter how I did it, right? It was this like, okay, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to go to church every Sunday morning, and it doesn't matter how I go to church. Or I'm going to have Christian friends, but it doesn't matter how I interact with my Christian friends, right? You know, or for me when I was younger, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to go to school and I'm going to wear a necklace with a cross on it so people know I'm a Christian, but it doesn't matter how I act as long as I know what I am. And in this, Jesus is raising the standard where he's like, okay, good, you're not a murderer, but how are you acting? Are you acting out of anger or are you acting out of love? Right? And even in verse 22, I'm going to read verse 22 again. He says, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever says you fool shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Which is, I mean, it's kind of crazy because there's like this escalation of like, well, you're guilty before the court and then before the Supreme Court and then guilty to go to the fiery hell. But it almost doesn't seem like the phrases get any worse. Like going from you good for nothing to you fool, it's like, well, this person didn't get any worse. How did this escalate? Right? But a lot of it is, and I mean, I mentioned this a couple minutes ago, but a lot of this is like the Bible talks about this over and over, but your mouth reveals what's in your heart. Right? In Psalms, it talks about your mouth speaks from the overflow of your heart. And in Luke chapter 6, I'm going to read this real fast. In Luke chapter 6, Jesus is talking about us producing fruit. And he says, for there is no good tree which produces bad fruit, nor on the other hand, a bad tree which produces good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit, for men do not gather figs from thorns, nor do they pick grapes from a briar bush. The good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth what is good. And the evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth what is evil, for his mouth speaks from that which fills the heart. I'm going to read that last verse again. The good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth what is good, and the evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth what is evil, for his mouth speaks from that which fills his heart. His mouth speaks from that which fills his heart. Even as I was reading this, it was so like humbling for me to think through the way I talk and the way I talk to people and about people and the way I talk about even other Christians, right? And the reality of it is if the purity of our words don't line up with our like what we believe, then our heart is in the wrong spot. Like if we're going about our life believing in Jesus and setting Jesus as our standard and our words don't line up with the purity of who Jesus is, like our heart's in the wrong spot. And I think a lot of times we have this luxury of separating like, oh, well, you know, even in the way we joke, for example, like, oh, I'm going to say this thing or I'm going to tear this person down or I'm going to not speak honor to somebody, but like, oh, I was joking, so it's okay. I think we all know somewhere in there, like a lot of our jokes have an element of truth in there somewhere. Like we wouldn't be joking about something unless somewhere in there we could grab onto something, right? And I think even in this, we can get so far down this path of like, well, you know, I'm not perfect. And then we just settle with like, well, I'm not perfect. And then we just get lazy with our words. And then all of a sudden we end up tearing people down and not honoring people and not honoring ourselves and not speaking honor of God. And Jesus is saying, like, that's revealing what's in your heart. And I want us all to just, like, take a second and think about how we talk to each other, how we talk about people, you know? Like, if you're talking about somebody, like, do you speak honor to them? Even people you're angry with. Because this isn't an isolated concept. Like, Jesus is saying, don't be angry, and think about like when you're angry with somebody, how hard it is to speak honor towards somebody you're angry with. Like you're annoyed, you're upset, you don't want to talk to this person. They've really done something to bother you, and you're angry with them. And it's just so easy to say the first thing that comes to mind, which is usually dishonoring and tears them down. But Jesus goes, look, if you're angry with somebody and you speak dishonor toward the person you're angry with,
your heart's in the wrong spot. Which is so hard. Like, I'm not preaching this as if I'm good at this. Like, that is so hard. It is so hard to stop yourself while you're angry and be like, okay, even though I'm angry at this person, I'm going to say stuff that honors them. But think about how, and Jesus says this, like, think about how you would want somebody else to treat you. Like, if you bothered somebody else and you unintentionally bothered somebody else, would you want them going behind your back and tearing you apart? Or would you want them believing the best in you and giving you the benefit of the doubt and honoring you, even though you messed up? Right? Like, that's what we all want. We want the other person to honor us and give us the benefit of the doubt and help us. But when somebody else bothers us, we turn around, it's so easy for us to be upset and be angry and dishonor them. And Jesus is saying, look, if you want a purity in heart, if you want to see God, right, in the Beatitudes, let's connect this. If you want to be pure in heart, if you want to be merciful, gentle, poor in spirit, right, if you want to hunger and thirst for righteousness, Jesus is saying, like, if you want that stuff, that involves honoring the people next to you, which goes into the next verse, Matthew 5. Verse 23 and 24, he says, therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar and remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering. I'm going to read that again. Therefore, if you're presenting your offering at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering. Okay, first I want to make sure we understand what this verse is talking about before I explain this. Like, what we're talking about here is we're talking about worshiping God, right? He says, therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar. Presenting your offering at the altar is you're going to worship God, right? To put it in our language, it's like you're going to go to church, right? Or you're going to go pray, right? And he's saying, if you're, I'm going to kind of translate this. He's basically saying, if you're going to go to church or pray or worship God, and remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother. And I think, okay, this is really important. I think all of us have experienced, and it might even be us this morning, we've all experienced us distracted by other relationships in life while we're trying to be at church, right? Like, because we have this routine of like, okay, well, I'm going to wake up on Sunday morning and I'm going to go to church, but you can't control life. So you get in an argument with your friend, right, on Saturday night, and you wake up and you're like, well, I have to go to church on Sunday morning. And you go to church, and the entire time you're at church, you're distracted during worship because you just had an argument, you know, with your husband or your wife or your friend the night before, and you're distracted at church because you're thinking about this argument that you had. Right, and you're thinking about, either you're thinking about how angry you are with the person, or you're thinking about how uncomfortable it was, or you're so sorry it happened, or whatever, but you're distracted, right? And we get in this habit of, like, because we have responsibilities to go to Christian things and do Christian things and pray and worship and whatnot, like, we think, well, let's just separate the two. It's like, well, I have the stuff that's going on in my life, but, like, I'm just going to leave that at the door, and I'm going to worship God, right? Which, even that's what I was taught growing up, of like, if you're going to be a Christian, you go to church, and when you walk in the church doors, you leave the inconveniences of your life at the door, and you come to worship God, because you need to worship God. And there's a good root in there, right? Like, somewhere in there, there's a root that says, like, no matter what your circumstances, you should be trusting and worshiping God, right? Yes, that's true. But here, Jesus is saying, like, don't compartmentalize your life, because it's going to hurt you. Because think about it, like, when you come to church, and even if this is you this morning, like, you come to church and you're angry or you're upset with somebody else, you're distracted. Like, you have a really hard time genuinely worshiping God or even thinking about God because you're busy thinking about something else. Like, before I get into some, like, crazy, like, spiritual definition, like, let's just get to the practical of, like, you're distracted, right? And God's saying, like, if there's something distracting you from worship, rather than, like, leaving it at the door and compartmentalizing it, he's like, deal with it. Because you are an entire being, right? You're not, I think it's easy for us to think of like, okay, well, we have our friendships and we have our marriage and then we have our school relationships and then we have our church friends and then we have me, right? And you're like, I am a culmination of all these sections. But Jesus is saying like, no, you're a whole person. Like if something's off in one of those categories, it's going to affect the rest of them. And unless we really grab a hold of the fact that Jesus wants all of our life and all of us, we're going to miss that and we're going to compartmentalize it, right? Unless we realize that reconciling with our friend is just as honoring to God as sitting in church, we're going to miss it. Because we're only gonna facilitate that compartmentalizing, right? And I think part of it too is even for me, like in my own life, I went through a season where it was just so easy for me to get so upset with Christians, and I was so like tired of the church, and I was so tired of Christianity, and I was like, man, this is annoying, because like a lot of the people I know who are Christians, like, they're kind of fake, right? And I would come to church, and I'd sit down, and I'd just get angry. And I'd sit there, and I'd, like, watch a worship leader lead worship, and I'd just judge him my whole time in my head, right? And then someone would get up and start speaking, and I would just judge them the whole time in my head. And I just got so bitter and so angry. And for some reason, I felt like that was okay, because I was like, well, at least I'm still going to church, right? Where I was like, I know I'm angry and I'm bitter, but I was like, well, at least I'm still sitting here. And in my head, I was like, well, that means God must be okay with that. But the problem is like, God knows our heart. And he's not like the people around us. We can fool the people around us, but we can't fool God, right? We all have friends. If we've been going to church long enough, we have friends who think we're a good Christian, right? If you're young and you grew up in a Christian family, like you have parents who want you to be a good Christian. And it's so easy for us to go through the motions and be like, well, at least all these people think I'm still a good Christian, so like I'm okay and I'm just going to keep walking through this. But I don't want to make this sound like you can't go to church angry, because like if there's any place you should be and be angry, like the church is a good place because Jesus is there to help you, right? But I am saying that the more we allow ourselves to compartmentalize, the more we forget that God's looking at our heart, right? He's saying like, okay, cool, you're not murdering somebody, but I see your heart and you're angry, right? Cool, you came and, you know, you're singing the worship songs, but I also know the argument you got in with your friend last night and you didn't reconcile with them. And part of the reason why this standard, why I'm kind of making such a big deal out of this standard, is in 1 John chapter 2, John writes, "The one who says he is in the light and yet hates his brother is in the darkness until now. The one who loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no cause for stumbling in him. But the one who hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes." But the one who hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes. John goes on to say, he says, "I have written to you, Father, I'm writing to you, little children, because your sins have been forgiven you for his name's sake. I'm writing to you, fathers, because you know him who has been from the beginning. I am writing to you, young men, because you have overcome the evil one. I have written to you, children, because you know the Father." So that's what he says right after this whole section about not loving your brother. And basically he's saying, like, look, I'm writing to you because you know Jesus. I'm writing to you because you've seen him and you know him and he's good. And he's saying, but if you don't love the person next to you, and especially even furthermore, like, if you don't love your brothers and sisters in Christ, like, what credit is it to you? And how can you claim to love God? And part of that is, you know, throughout the New Testament, there's this language of how can you claim to love somebody you can't see, which is God, if you can't love somebody you can see. Right? Like, this whole thing is, Jesus is saying, like, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is saying, like, your beliefs about God are revealed in the things you say and how you treat the people next to you. Like, your belief, even in, you know, verse 23 and 24 of Matthew 5, when he talks about leaving your offering at the altar to reconcile with your brother, he's like, your beliefs about worship are revealed by how you treat the people next to you. Be first reconciled to your brother, and first love your brothers and sisters. And this is something that I think I've found to be the biggest shift in my own life when it comes to the ways I've approached God, is that I think there's a difference between following God to get God and following God to be like Him. And I think sometimes I've had selfish motives in wanting to be a Christian, or selfish motives in wanting to follow God, because I had this conception, well, if I just become a really good Christian, right, and if everybody thinks I'm a really good Christian, right, if I become the worship leader or become the pastor and everybody thinks I'm a really good Christian, right, I'm going to get all these blessings and things are going to get easier. But the more I read this book and the more I let this book challenge me, the more I sat back and I was like, wait a second, the point of this thing is that if I follow Jesus, I should become like Him. And becoming like Him is so much harder. And this is, I think, the beauty of the gospel. Like, the beauty of the gospel is that Jesus said, hey, your goal is to become like me, and I've made it possible through my grace. But the even as I say that, like, the question I have to ask is, like, do you even want to be like Jesus? Like, there's a church answer of, like, oh, I believe in Jesus, I want to be like Him. But, like, do you want to be like Him? Like, do you read this and go, that is somebody that I want to be like? Because I think it's one thing if we say we love Jesus in the same way we say we love pumpkin pie, right? Of, like, oh, I really appreciate it. It's nice when it's around. I like it, tastes good, not too expensive, right? It's one thing to say we love Jesus like that, and it's another thing to say you love Jesus like you love your spouse, for example, right? Like, that depth of relationship and that depth of wanting somebody to be around and be with and longing for the connection with somebody. And then it's a whole nother level to say you love Him in that I want to be just like you. And this is what God asks of us, right? Like, throughout Matthew and throughout the Sermon on the Mount, throughout 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, throughout basically the whole New Testament, Jesus is saying, and the apostles are writing and saying, like, if you're going to be like God, or if you're going to love Jesus, your actions have to line up with what Jesus does, which means you have to talk like Him and walk like Him. And the reality of that is it's really, 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 really hard and impossible, in fact, without His grace, right? But if there's anything I've learned about humanity, is when we set ourselves a low standard, we get lazy. Unless we set ourselves an impossibly high standard, we don't do it, right? Like, for those of us who are in schools, if to get, you know, a six-figure perfect job, right, and to graduate perfectly, you only had to get C's, none of us would try, right? We'd, you know, maybe study for 10 minutes, but, like, if all you needed was C's, you'd be like, eh, I'm fine. Like, C's aren't that hard to get, right? But because we've set ourselves a standard somewhere in our head of like A's are the things that we need, we do ridiculous things to get A's, right? We sit in libraries for 10 hours and do things that are uncomfortable for us because we've set ourselves in a crazy high standard, right? And it's like most of the time when somebody sets us a low standard, we don't try very hard. And even when somebody sets us a high standard, if we still think we can do it, we still don't try very hard. And it's not until we really set ourselves a basically impossible standard do we actually try, right? Like that's just human nature. It's for some reason we just want to be lazy. And this is what Jesus is doing. Jesus is going, look, I've set you an impossibly high standard because I know that's the only thing that's going to get you to really strive after it, and I've given you the grace through the cross to mess up along the way, but your standard's me. Your standard is the narrow way to life, right? Jesus says, Jesus says that the path to life is narrow, right? We all know this verse of like, there's a wide path that leads to destruction and the narrow is a path that leads to life. And I think part of it is, I think we've lost, and when I say we, I'm not like, obviously I don't know very many of you, so I'm not like talking about, when I say we, I'm talking about a lot of just Christian culture in general. I think we've lost the reality that the way to life is narrow. And Jesus says not many people are going to find it, right? And it should humble us. Like, we should sit there and, okay, when you talk about, has everybody heard the parable of the sower where the seed falls on the grounds? Have we heard this? Right? Good. Okay, so basically there's this parable where Jesus talks about seed falling on the ground, right? And he gives this picture of like, you know, the seed falls on the rocky soil, the seed falls on the concrete, the seed falls on good soil, you know, and then the seed falls on the soil where it grows for a little bit and then gets choked out, right? And he gives these four scenarios. Now, I'm not saying this is like a literal percentage to like what happens in the world, but when you look at that parable, there are four groups of people that got the seed. Four out of four got the seed, right? Which means four out of four heard the gospel. And one out of four got Jesus. Like, when I say the way is narrow, I'm like, it's what, four out of four people heard Jesus. And I think a lot of times we're sitting there like, well, as long as I, you know, hear about Jesus and go to church and kind of like the gospel thing, like I'm okay. Like, four out of four people heard Jesus and one out of four got him. The second one got him for a little bit, and then the Bible says that it grew for a little bit, and then the riches and comforts of the world choked it out, which is a lot of us, right? That's me. That convicts me, like, every time, because I'm like, man, the comforts of the world get me to ignore Jesus a lot. But this concept of the way being narrow should so hold us accountable to, like, we have to give Jesus everything we got. Which means when we're striving for having a pure, in the Beatitudes, like having a pure heart, being poor in spirit, being gentle, being hunger and thirsting for righteousness, and then when it goes into what I've talked about today with, you know, the way we talk about people and the way we approach worship and reconciling with the people around us and not compartmentalizing our life, like all of that is the way to the narrow life. Like all of that is the way to find the narrow path, and the narrow path is hard. Jesus says not many people are going to find it, and a lot of the reason why not many people are going to find it is because not many people are going to want it bad enough to actually change, right? The amount I spent, like, 18 years of my life going to church, and I never wanted to change enough to actually do anything that was uncomfortable. And I never wanted to let Jesus change me enough to actually give up my life. I spent 18 years listening about the gospel, and I was too scared and honestly too apathetic to let Jesus actually change me. But then I read this and I'm like, guys, how much of a waste would it be if you spend your entire life in the church guys, think about this. This is like a really scary thought, but I really want us to get this, of like how much of a waste it would be if you spend your entire life in the church, right? You spend 75, 80 years of your life in the church, following Jesus, right? Going to church, worshiping, reading the Bible, all this stuff, and you get to heaven, to the gates of heaven, and Jesus goes, "Depart from me, for I never knew you." That's like Jesus, in Matthew, Jesus says, like, some of you are going to come to me on the last day and say, "Didn't we prophesy and cast out demons in your name?" And he's going to go, "I don't know you." How much of a waste would it be if we spent our life in the church, but we spent the whole time not actually letting Jesus get to the root of who we are and change us, that we miss it? Right? And I think part of it is, like, I know this is, like, kind of weird because I've never been here and then I'm preaching something, like, really heavy. And I almost feel like I don't have a right to do it. But at the same time, I can't in good conscience talk about Jesus and not express the reality that, like, this thing is serious. Like, I so wish growing up somebody just sat me down and was like, "Hey, if you don't change, you're going to miss it." Like, I wish somebody sat me down and said, like, "Hey, this is a lot more serious than what you think it is." Because my whole life, I had people around me who were just trying to get me to go to church, and then I'd go, and they'd be like, "Ah, fun, huh, go home," right? Like, nobody sat me down and was like, "Hey, you can do all the spiritual stuff. You can do all the right stuff, right? You can follow all the laws," right? When Jesus says, "Don't commit murder," like, you can follow all the laws, and if your heart isn't right, if your heart isn't pure, you're still going to miss it. And I think a lot of this is, like, where we get our frustration. I had this conversation a couple days ago, and I'm going to end with this, but I had this conversation a couple days ago where sometimes the way we approach truth is, like, okay, think of, like, the chair you're sitting in, right? Sometimes the way we approach truth is, it's one thing to go, "I believe this chair is here." Someone goes, "Do you think this chair is here?" I'm like, "Yes, I think that chair is here. I see it. It's there," right? And it's another thing to so believe in what the chair is that you're going to put your entire weight on it and know you're not going to fall, right? And I think this is a lot of times what we do with Jesus. Is somebody goes, "Is Jesus real?" And we look at him and we go, "He's real. He's there," right? And then Jesus says, "All right, if I'm real, put your entire weight on me." And we stand there and we go, "I can't do that." Like, yeah, you're there. You know, like, thinking of the chair illustration, it's like, yes, the chair's there, but I don't believe the chair is real enough for me to put my whole weight on it, but I'm willing to say it's there. And if, at the end of that, it's like, do I really believe the chair is the chair if I'm not willing to sit on it, right? Like, it just sounds silly to us, right? We're like, "Oh, I really need a rest," and somebody brings up a chair, and you're like, "No, but I'm not going to sit there because I don't think it's going to hold me." And they're like, "What? I just gave this to you for you to rest." You know, like, to us, it's silly to believe the chair is there and not sit on it. But that's what we do with God, right? Is we're like, "I believe he's there, but I'm not going to put my entire weight on him." But the goodness of the gospel is that when you put your entire weight on Jesus, he actually carries it. Like, that's why he says when you lose your life, you're going to find it. Right? It's because when you actually put your entire weight on him and you actually let him change the core of who you are, he's going to be there to support you. And the only way to really find out is to do it. Because a lot of the reason why a lot of us end up being in and out is because we never fully put our weight on Jesus, and he never has a chance to really prove himself to us. Because the reality is, like, if we put our entire weight on Jesus and he doesn't show up, like, I mean, we might as well go home. But there are countless people throughout history who have put their entire weight on Jesus, and Jesus has shown up and answered their prayers. And that's, like, that's why I'm following this God, is because I've seen people put their entire weight on him, and I'm like, wow, that God's real. Like, he carries the people who put their weight on him. And so I just want to leave us with this challenge and this push to, if we believe in Jesus, let's put our entire weight on him, because he's going to carry it. He will. I promise. And he's going to give us that purity in heart to be poor in spirit, to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Like, he's going to give it to us when we put our full weight on him. Because he loves us.